Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. My name is Mayan Kreitzman, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Neil Janssen.
Hi, I'm Neil. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
On today's show, we have our weekly news roundup. Will McDonald, the coordinating editor of the UBC, will be joining us for that. He's also staying on for our second segment, in which we grill AMS President Aaron Bailey about the opening of the new sub, AMS's plans for this year, and the society's response to recent turmoil in UBC's leadership.
To start things off, we've got Will McDonald in the studio with us here today.
Will is the coordinating editor of the UBC, the official student newspaper at UBC. Welcome to the show, Will.
Hi, folks.
So I think to start off our first episode, there's only one story we can really talk about, and that is that of our mysteriously disappearing president, Arvind Gupta. I know you've been following this a lot, right, Will?
Oh, yeah. That's definitely been the biggest stories we're working on right now.
So one of the interesting things that the UBC added to this story was the discovery of a secret board meeting on August 17th. Can you walk us through how exactly that happened?
Yeah, so it was kind of just a happy accident that we picked up on and ran with. We were in the office Monday morning, ready to put together a print issue of the paper. We had written an editorial about the lack of transparency at the Board of Governors, and our old file photo of the board was where a board used to meet, Engage. So I sent our photo editor, Costa, over to the Alumni Center to take a photo of what was supposed to be, you know, a closed door of the room where they meet. He gets there to take the photo and is told to come back because there's a meeting going on right then. So he comes back to the office and told me that, and I said, hold on a minute, we need to get over there. So he went back, and our news editor, Maura, followed up, and from there we basically sat outside the meeting and covered it from there, and you were there as well, Neil. So.
That's right, I was there. I arrived when the building had been evacuated due to a fire alarm. That is still mysterious, right?
Yeah, no one's owned up to it. It seems strange that shortly after we found out the meeting, the fire alarm goes off. No fire trucks showed up, so go figure, because they almost always show up when it goes off at the sub.
And I have a buddy who works in the Alumni Center who said that was not a pre-planned drill. And yeah, what happened afterwards is I was sitting with Moira, the news editor, outside in the hallway of the Alumni Center, and up the stairs walks Richard Johnston, who's a member of the board. To me, that's a good sign. The board must be still up there meeting. We'll just keep waiting for them outside. Until about 10 seconds after he goes up the stairs, he comes right back down. Moira stopped him and asked him about the meeting and what happened, and he kind of said, I can't tell you about it because I'm not there yet, and then walks out the building. And so we immediately pack up our stuff and follow him across campus to Old Admin Building.
Maura did a great job live-tweeting with help from Neil, too. Both Neil and Maura were kind of just sitting out there watching people coming in and out of the meeting, tweeting about what was going on, and Neil had a pretty good catch with a certain someone coming into the meeting.
Yeah, Judy Kirk, who's a PR expert, showed up and went right into the room. I recognize her from having worked with her in UBC context before, and I knew there was only one reason she could be there, which was damage control for the board. And we had a good time, too, because there are other media outlets that showed up eventually, right?
Yeah, CBC was there for a bit and then left, and Global came and stayed to the end, including basically just following Montalbano from when he finally left the meeting, just asking questions the whole time till he got to his car, none of which he really answered.
There was another mysterious moment when Montalbano crossed the hallway to take a 45-minute phone call?
Yeah, ballpark about 45 minutes.
Did we ever find out who he was talking with for so long?
No answers there. Could quite likely be someone with the provincial government, but no one said what's going on. He rushed through and then came back and, as usual, took no questions.
Yeah, it was fun following those Twitter feeds on that day, and the Global reporter had a pretty epic chase down to the car. So it was a good media event all around. Nice catch, you guys.
Thanks.
So where do things stand now? There's been a lot of letters put out by all sorts of groups demanding various things, and now Martha Piper has been installed as interim president. Where do you think the story goes from here?
From here, the Faculty Association, among other groups, they want answers as to why Gupta left. No one seems to be giving those. They're citing non-disclosure agreements, but now the debate is should those agreements exist in the first place, which I think is an important one to be having. Piper's now in office. To be honest, I don't know that she's going to be doing much or changing much. She's only here for a year, so that's not very long. I think the story now is FOI is coming back. It's the fallout as to what happens next.
Has the UBC filed FOIs?
Yeah, we filed quite a few.
And what's the role of Kirk & Co., the Judy Kirk that you saw in that meeting?
When I worked with her, it was on a consultation process about the NCAA, but her firm is definitely known more as a public relations firm, or as they would call it, strategic communications. It's hard to imagine what her role could possibly be with the UBC Board of Governors, except to help them and the chair, John Montalbano, through what has happened with the allegations made against him by Jennifer Birdall.
Right, and I mean, I think it's important to recognize the accomplishment, basically, of the Faculty Association in managing to get John Montalbano to step aside and in establishing the quote-unquote fact-finding process that's going to ensue. It's not clear to me that that would have happened if the Faculty Association hadn't gone to bat so hard with those quite aggressive letters. What's your guys' take on their role in this whole story?
Well, I mean, I think it's nice to see someone speaking up about things. Very few people are actually saying something. I think UBC's strategy is be quiet and hope that it stays under the rug, and the more people will actually not let it go under the rug, the better off we are to actually get some answers as to what's going on.
And in addition to Montalbano not saying anything, no board member seems to have said anything anywhere, right, Will?
We've heard nothing. We've had multiple requests for comments, both from our student reps to other board reps to the board chair. Nothing.
It's disappointing that the student reps haven't piped up because they don't have to break any sort of non-disclosure agreement in order to make some sort of comment.
Also, correction, the one thing they have said to us after multiple prods or comment was just that they are engaged in the process, that they're at the meetings, which is exactly what Montalbano said about them in an interview with Global earlier that day. So convenience that they said exactly the same thing as the board chair on their comment about how involved they are.
So just to summarize Gupta Gate, as somebody originally dubbed it.
I like Gone Gupta better.
Gone Gupta.
There's a great illustration on Twitter.
I think the comment I made is that he's hiding right now. He's holed up in his lake house with his first love, academia.
So how do we see the fallout of all this over the next couple months or even couple years? This has been a majorly destabilizing event for the university, and the ramifications of it aren't restricted to the next month or two.
Well, the next little while, I mean, university is very clearly in damage control mode. They're hoping that there's not going to be, I think, too much pressure on to feel what actually happened, and we plan to continue to apply that. Who knows? The information could come out as to why Gupta left. I don't think it's going to come out voluntarily from the university, but we're pushing for that. I think the more important thing for how it plays out long term is this is starting some actual people to push for reform of the Board of Governors, and the thing that matters is will that happen?
And what happens to Arvind Gupta himself? In theory, he's still at the university. Does anyone know where he is right now?
I've heard rumors from him being in Kelowna to him being in an apartment in Vancouver now.
And at some point, he's going to have to show up on campus again. He's off on his one-year leave of absence, but he's still a professor at UBC. And once that year is up, unless he's found somewhere else to go, he's going to have to be on campus at some point, right? He can't just not show up to UBC for the rest of his life. And at that point, people will probably start asking the same questions they have now.
That's the thing, is these questions aren't going to go away. I know he doesn't seem to want to answer them now. Presumably, he's going to answer, or there'll be some very awkward moments at UBC with Gupta walking around saying, "Oh, nothing to see here."
So can we have three cheers for the renegotiation of that non-disclosure agreement? That's what I'd be in favor of. I guess that brings us to the response or lack thereof from the two student societies, the AMS and the GSS. The GSS ended up coming up with some statements that have some meaning, but it wasn't so easy to get them to do that. And the AMS's statement remains sort of like ambiguously vacuous. But I guess we'll have Aaron Bailey on to discuss that. Okay, on that note, let's move on to some other news briefs. We have one item about the Aquatic Center funding. Apparently UBC is $11 million short on the money for that project. Neil, any comments on that?
No, just that the board right now, in their lack of transparency, is asking us to trust them as responsible stewards of the university and that we should just leave them to it. Well, there's a new aquatic center being built by the bus loop right now that they approved, counting on having $11.9 million in donor funding. And according to reports in the UBC, they've raised $0 of that so far. So it's kind of hard to take them seriously as these vaunted, you know, managers of the university that we must respect because they are all-knowing and wonderful.
Well, especially on the fiscal side, that's supposed to be their job, money and policy. Leave the academics to the Senate, but it seems like even that's not so easy to do. Next, UBC has announced that they're not accepting credit card payments for housing, meal plans, and international tuition anymore, which is supposed to save the university $2.7 million every year. Credit cards were canceled as a payment option for domestic tuition back in 2011. I remember that as an undergrad. Is this at all controversial? It just seems like a good idea.
I think the part where it would be controversial is just that there was really not any notice, and that now students who formerly were expecting to pay with a credit card, now that's not an option for them, and they didn't really have much notice to account for that if that's going to be a problem.
And I think UBC was put in a rather tough place here because they did have their block grant from the province cut by $8 million this year. The $8 million cut to funding meant that UBC had to find some money somewhere, and I think they saw this as one of the less painful ways of doing it. And of course, they've promised to give alternative means of payment for international students especially.
All right. Changes to the government RESP, i.e. Registered Education Savings Plan Program. What's up with that?
So at the same time as the government is cutting direct funding to universities, they have announced that every child in the year that they turn six is eligible to get a $1,200 contribution from the government to the RESP to help them pay the insanely high tuition that they'll surely face by the time they reach college age.
Ooh, the neoliberalization of education. All right, that's what we've got for news briefs today.
In studio with my co-host Mayan, and you are listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Our interview guest today is Aaron Bailey, 106th and current president of the Alma Mater Society.
Hey, Neil.
Aaron, thanks for being our guest on the very first episode. That's pretty big of you.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
So I think the first thing you wanted to clarify was how you're coming to us today.
Yeah. So just so I can speak candidly, I'm here speaking as Aaron Bailey. I'm also the AMS president, but I'm not speaking on behalf of council.
Okay, Aaron, so you're originally from Niagara Falls, Ontario. Maybe you could just briefly share with us how you ended up at UBC and how you got interested in the AMS.
Yeah, so I was born in southern Ontario in Niagara Falls. Sort of normal upbringing, went through high school, got kind of involved with student politics there, obviously on a different scale. I really liked planning events and making positive difference for students at my high school. I was lucky enough to actually receive a scholarship to come out to UBC when UBC used to give scholarships back in the day. And that's the only real reason that I ended up out west. It was always a dream of mine being such a beautiful place and such a wonderful campus, and I'm just happy that I got out here and got the chance to get involved.
So last year you were quite critical of the AMS's response to residents and tuition hikes, and you said that they lacked passion and didn't demonstrate real desire to fight on behalf of the students. And that was, like, in spite of last year that there was quite a bit of grassroots momentum from the I'm a Student hashtag movement that staged some pretty impressive protests. So UBC is proposing more substantial tuition hikes this year, and we were wondering if the AMS is going to be taking a different approach.
Yeah, so obviously tuition and the sort of budgetary situation of the university is always going to be on the books, at least for the foreseeable future, and it's something the AMS needs to be more actively involved in. I think from the get-go, we need to really engage with students who are raising their voices and getting involved, whether they're in support or against or whatever that position is going to look like in the coming year. I think one thing we didn't do very well is consult students beyond that annual general meeting that we had. We didn't really follow up on the momentum that was gained there with the student body. And I think it was kind of a mirror image of what the university was doing. It was failing to talk to students and really sort of pay homage to the intelligence of the student body here and ask them for meaningful solutions to the budgetary problems that the university is facing, as opposed to just asking them if they're okay with this sort of arbitrary fee increase solution they came up with.
So what are alternatives like that? Like, I haven't met too many students that are in favor of higher tuition, but I don't actually know of that many students that have a lot of nuance on what lower student fees could look like or how the university runs itself.
Yeah, well, I think a first sort of key question to ask is, what are students' priorities for this institution? You know, obviously we do have budgetary pressures with government funding being reduced and things like that, but the question has never been asked to students, where is your value for the money that you're getting? You know, are fee increases necessary for the expansion of capital projects or for expanding our departments and things like that, attracting new faculty? Or would you rather pay less and sort of sacrifice those sorts of things? Or are there other solutions that we can investigate collaboratively as an institution to these budgetary issues? I think those aren't the questions that are being asked. It's just assumed that expansion, growth, rankings mean so much to the student body, and the only solution to that is more money, which right now seems to only be able to come from international student tuition.
But is the university ready to have that conversation? Because the university certainly releases budgetary info for this year, but I don't think they tell anyone where they're expecting to be in 3 years or 5 years. But this is certainly something that they have to be looking ahead towards and thinking about. So do you think the university will be willing to talk about where they expect to be in 3 and 5 years to have conversations like that?
That's a really good question. I think the first point is us asking for them to consider whether they want to have that conversation. I don't think the AMS has really done that. It's more been reactionary in nature, where when things happen and there's an ill effect on students or there's student resilience against that, that's when the AMS kind of pipes in and gets into those conversations. But again, we want to be at the table consulting on behalf of students before the problems arise and really bringing those preferences to the administration before it's a reactionary process.
Maybe something that feeds into a bit about how do you convey students' concerns to administration or to the university, and I think that would lead into the statement that the AMS put out the other week as to its position on the whole board situation. So maybe you want to just fill in people as to what that statement was.
Yeah, so the statement sort of, it had a few different points. It was crafted by the entirety of council in a council meeting. But what it basically iterated, a little different from other people who have made statements currently, we weren't calling for the resignation at that time of the board chair, considering the fact that we really thought that more instability in the institution would have a negative impact on students throughout this year. We also demanded for an investigation that was unbiased and external into the supposed breaches, the sort of proposed breaches that were brought up. We also called on the AMS as an organization to continue to work towards more transparency with the Board of Governors, engaging with our student representatives and other mechanisms that we're sort of considering and pondering right now. So those are sort of the key pieces and the messages we wanted to get across.
So what does that do for students?
For students, really, what we're trying to affirm is we want this year to not be affected in terms of the day-to-day experience and the student experience for individuals and our constituents.
Another thing on that statement, there seems to be, I guess, a discrepancy between what council voted on and what statement was sent out. Do you want to maybe explain what happened there?
So speaking about how the sort of statement was prepared, it's my job in my duties and what I was elected to do to be the spokesperson for the society and to craft statements like this. So with our communications department, I crafted this statement and I made the active decision to come to council to have their opinion on it before we released it. What they actually passed were points to follow in terms of modifying the statement that already existed. And in the conversation we had, there was nothing that was pointed out about actually removing the pieces on institutional stability and the representation of students by the AMS. So what I did, and with communications department after that actual council meeting, is took the points that council wanted us to edit and sort of iterate in that and included them in the statement that I already brought to them for consultation.
But you didn't take anything out?
No, I didn't, because I wasn't like asked to take anything out. So if council had said, we don't think institutional stability being paramount matters to us and we want it to be removed, if that was something that was spoken about or was included in this motion, absolutely I would have taken it out, because that's my job. I kind of take directive from council.
So why is institutional stability more important than, say, asking for reforms or trying to drive change?
So I think right now we don't have enough information to ask for reform, and we don't have enough information to drive change. I think as university students, we should really hold sort of factual information and sound sort of ground to stand on when we're asking for these things as paramount, because without doing that, you don't really have a logical basis for asking for change. We think until we know that there's a clear mandate for that that instability to be created, we shouldn't be asking for it at the behest of our students.
I mean, my issue with that take is UBC doesn't need more encouragement to stay in the inertia, the status quo that they're in. Mm-hmm. They don't need your help. What they do need, in my opinion, would be a stronger student voice advocating for our interests.
Yeah, no, I agree with you as well. I think had we taken a different stance, one that's been taken by other groups on campus and in sort of the greater community, we could have just asked, you know, we think he should resign because we don't have enough information about the situation. But for us, that's calling for a very major action on the basis of speculation right now, and we don't think that that is a logical way to go about things.
Okay, but what about asking to put an end to the speculation through a dissolution, a renegotiation of a confidentiality agreement? The MS had nothing to say about that.
That's true. It wasn't in that meeting the will of our council, who are the people who are elected to sort of help the president, again, speak on behalf of students. We're in a tricky situation because it's summer. There aren't very many students on campus. It's hard for us to really have a pulse on what the student body wants until our full constituents, like the sort of body of constituents, returns to campus. If there is a demand from our students that comes through their council members who are elected for that to be the case, we have no problems publishing that and saying that's the stance the AMS takes, right? We're reactive to the people who elected us on that council, and that's kind of just the only way we're able to function.
So on that note, when you were running to be AMS president earlier this year, you wrote a piece called State of the Student Union about the ills of the AMS and your diagnosis and solutions. I'm just going to read part of what you wrote there, which is the following. Recently, however, the focus has been on keeping the machine oiled in order to stay afloat, and the lack of meaningful risk-taking has created disillusionment among students. For the AMS to truly reignite engagement, it needs to be willing to take chances, make mistakes, and get messy. For this to happen, a push is needed from the AMS president. I'm having a bit of trouble reconciling that tone with a society now trumpeting stability above all. And as a side note, I'd even like to think that Ms. Frizzle would have called the university out on their BS.
That's fair. I love the words of Ms. Frizzle. Again, I wrote that when there was a mandate from students on an issue for the AMS to take action. There were students who were vocal. They took to the streets. They took to the internet. They were very, very clear about the stance that they wanted the AMS to take on this issue, and the AMS didn't take that stance. So
was that about the tuition issue?
Yeah, it was about the tuition and the residence fee issue. Right now, we don't have that from the student body. If that changes and there is a demand from students for that to be the stance the AMS takes, I have absolutely no qualms with taking those risks and being more hard-nosed in that position. But right now, we don't have the information to do so.
I think one thing keeps coming up, you're saying, oh, there's a lack of information, so we're not going to take a strong stance. I mean, I think that's the issue, is that there's a lack of information from the board and there's no strong stance pushing them to provide more information. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that that's ever going to change. You say, unless students come out and protest, or unless we have clear information, well, they're not giving information and they're not being pushed to do it otherwise.
Yeah, it's not an accident that they don't have that information, and that's part of the problem.
True. And again, I have no more information than you do. I do know it's a personnel matter. It's an individual's life that we're talking about and their career. And if this individual signed a non-disclosure agreement and a confidentiality agreement out of their own free will, it's hard for me as an individual, not speaking as AMS president, to expect this person to breach that to appease, again, something that I perceive personally as a witch hunt going on.
Wait, who's the witch in the analogy?
I guess John Montalbano would be the witch in this case. Just to be clear, he voluntarily stepped aside so this investigation could take place.
He voluntarily stepped aside when he was volunteered to step aside by by a lot of pressure that was brought to bear in a week long of negotiations with the faculty association. It's not like he did that out of the goodness of his own heart.
That's
if
fair.
If that's what he wanted to do, he would have done that a week and a half earlier.
And I think also from pressure from the AMS asking for an unbiased external and, you know, a review that actually would be meaningful with this person not in that position.
So I should mention we're sitting here in the beautiful new AMS student nest in the studios of CITR, looking out at the Knoll.
Yeah, looking out at the Knoll, we can see the Knoll on the inside of the sub, the continuation of the Knoll on the outside of the sub, and the shiny new studios of CITR, which are quite accessible and visible to anyone who walks by. It seems to me like perennially there's just a tension in the role of the AMS as a provider of services, for example, running the sub, all the businesses in the sub, supporting clubs, and its role as a political advocacy voice for students. Like, the service providing AMS doesn't necessarily benefit from rocking the boat, whereas the political side, that's not the case, and there could be real long-term benefits to being more aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you see that trade-off, or if you see it as a trade-off.
So, it's a big organization. The services propagate because we have phenomenal people working in services and overseeing that. I think we do offer a ton of amazing services to students. And again, whether they know the AMS provides them or not, I think isn't really the baseline. It's just the fact that they have access to these resources when they need them. I think there are sort of concrete facts that we have to grapple with about this place, UBC. It's a behemoth, it's an institution, and it moves at a very, very slow pace. Sometimes there are trade-offs between being aggressive and taking principled stances versus being strategic and political, trying to move things forward for students out of their best interest.
Maybe we can circle back to AMS Council last night.
Where I was there. I think one discussion that came up, there wasn't really much debate over it, was I think it was what was official name was exec and council relationship, mm-hmm. and it seemed to be the meat behind that was who's in charge here.
That discussion is one that I think we should have at the beginning of every single year. What we really wanted to talk about was how involved does council want to be in the day-to-day operations of the society, you know? We have a very, very interesting governance structure at the AMS where your executives, who are kind of your operational student government people, also sit on your board that has the vote in terms of the higher level strategic planning and that kind of thing. I mentioned in council that over the past few years, we've had the pendulum swung in two very different directions where, you know, it's very nitty-gritty. Council wants to be involved in every single thing that happens, which isn't right or wrong. It's just a different approach to where the council as a board of directors wants to be more high-level, do strategic decision-making, and kind of let the executives do the day-to-day stuff.
So what should it be? Who's in charge?
I think, frankly, the council is in charge, and they get to decide how much of that power that they hold they devolve to the executives to use on a day-to-day basis. I report to council as like an operational elected individual for the society, and what they say kind of goes in my job, and that's a belief that I hold.
So if council tells you to do something, you'll do it even if you don't want to?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we heard that the executive chef, Ryan Bissell, is departing.
Yeah.
And we were just wondering why that's happening and what the effect of that is going to be on all of the food outlets.
Definitely. So Ryan's been with us for over 2 years. He was an absolutely phenomenal asset to the team. He's one of the key players in why we have such great businesses and such great food value for students in the new space. He got a phenomenal opportunity in Whistler. So he's working at a 5-star restaurant in Whistler now, cooking. It's a dream of his, and it's a good progression for his culinary career. Sad to see him go, and naturally with personnel changes, especially in a role as integral as the executive chef, there's going to be a little bit of slowing. But he did so much work in preparing us for the building that it's kind of ready to just press go when students get here next week.
So there's no dirt on that? Like, it seems a little strange that he would depart a couple weeks before the flagship restaurant at the new Nest is opening.
Nope. So there's no dirt. Our perch manager is still there. The culinary team is still there. He just got a wonderful job opportunity and he jumped on it. And this is what happens when you have an organization that has professional staff with really, really amazing careers and credentials. Sometimes they get picked up by other organizations and, you know, it's something you deal with on a day-to-day basis.
So do you want to tell us your favorite part of the new building?
My favorite part of the new building? I think my favorite part's the rock climbing wall. So I picked up a membership. It's $50 for the full year run by Varsity Outdoors Club, and I've been trying to climb at least once a week. It's a good way to sort of clear my head when things are getting kind of crazy in the office.
Well, I think that's a very good place to wrap up. Thank you very much, Aaron, for stopping by and being our first guest on UBC Insiders On Air.
No worries. Thank you again for the coverage that you do on our campus. You guys do awesome work.
And best of luck for the year.
Cheers.
So, Neil, what did you think about our chat with Aaron?
I thought it was really good. He definitely was pretty candid with us, and I think he outlined some of the challenges he faces and that sometimes you're going to disappoint some people and that there might be answers that he has that are balancing interests but may leave lots unsatisfied.
Yeah, he definitely came across as a super genuine guy. It's nice to just sit next to somebody and see their faces there, trying really hard to explain and justify, even if that does sort of fall short. I guess what we insisted on trying to understand with the AMS statement that was released and the discrepancy between that and what was passed at AMS Council, he had a sort of interesting take on that, which was basically the idea that he will put in what council wants him to put in, but he won't take out anything the council doesn't explicitly tell him not to say. What was your impression of that version of events?
Having attended the meeting, that was not the impression that I had sitting in the audience. At best, it would have been ambiguous to councillors to know what exactly they were doing to the statement that had been presented to them.
So I guess future recommendations for AMS Council, make sure you understand what is the press release and what is the motion that you're passing and what is the exact relationship between those two documents.
Always do your homework, AMS Council. That's a pretty good general rule of thumb, always.
And in general, this is a call out to counselors at the AMS, at the GSS. Be dorky. Please, be dorky. Ask. Be that activist-y, obnoxious counselor. And the whole bar will be raised on the executive and on your fellow counselors. Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman in studio with my co-host, Neil Janssen, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and podcast at citr.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders, check out our blog, ubcinsiders.ca, or email us. We're both very easy to find on Google, unlike most board members. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, Mayan, and we'll talk to you all next week. We've been lining up shows all about the board politics, housing policy, grad student issues, and why every single square inch of campus cannot seem to escape aggressive redevelopment.
Cannot wait. Insiders out.